was sticking in her heart had been sticking in her body. She looked like a porcupine. And she asked me, she said, BB, do you think I've lived my life all wrong? And I thought about it. I really didn't want to give her no bad advice, so I thought about it. And this is what I said. No, you better not look down if you're going to keep on flying. Keep the hammer down and keep it full and stay ahead. You better not look back or you might just wind up crying. You can even prove it if you don't look down. One morning in London, England, and I saw this long...
Hello out there, this is Jello Biafra. If you're tired of the OCA, Walt Disney, Westinghouse, General Electric, and police departments telling you what you should listen to, stay tuned in to KBOO Portland, listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio, 90.7 on your FM dial, unless your FM was made in America.
Tune in every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for variations on the theme of folk music during KBOO's Folk Strip. Each morning brings you a different DJ and a wonderful variety of acoustic and roots music, both traditional and contemporary. You'll hear the latest from singer-songwriters, happy jigs and reels, bluesy folk, a sea shanty or two, some old favorites, local artists and artists from around the world, a touch of Cajun, a dose of indie, and a smidge of jug band. It's probably the best way on earth to wake up. So let us start your day with a smile. Again, that's every weekday morning from 5:30 to 7 a.m. for KBOO's folk music programs.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to The Occasion. I'm your host, Jennifer Perrine, and this is episode 9. The Occasion is a themed poetry show featuring interviews with poets who offer a selection of their greatest hits, read poems written specifically for the occasion of the show, and recommend some of their favorite poems by other authors. So a little of something old, something new, something borrowed, and something true. Before we get started, I want to thank everyone in our community who's been pulling together, creating new programming, and keeping KBOO not just on the air, but also fresh and relevant. KBOO is here for you through the COVID shutdown, covering the movement for social justice, and providing you with news, music, and arts and culture programming. KBOO is in its fall membership drive, and I'd like to remind our listeners that you can support our work by going to kboo.fm and clicking the donate button. If you donate now through October 31st, your contribution will be matched dollar per dollar up to $4,500. If you make a donation during this show, you'll also have the option of requesting one of my poetry books as a thank you gift. And you can also show your support for KBOO by telling your friends about our work, sharing about KBOO on social media, or volunteering your time and expertise. If you're interested in volunteering, you can find more information at the Get Involved link online at kboo.fm. And now on to the show. It's October 2020, and the theme for this month is magic. Our guest tonight is Ingrid Wendt. Ingrid has authored 5 books of poems and co-edited the Oregon poetry anthology From Here We Speak and In Her Own Image, Women Working in the Arts. A visiting poet in hundreds of classrooms nationwide and abroad, she has read her poems to open the Oregon State Legislature. Her work has 3 times been featured in Garrison Keillor's The Writer's Almanac. Recent poems have appeared in Poetry, Terrain, Valparaiso Poetry Review, About Place, Cascadia, Cirque, The Poeming Pigeon, and Windfall. To read more, visit ingridwent.com. Welcome, Ingrid. This month's theme is magic, and I'm hoping you could start us off with a poem of or two of yours so we can hear how that theme has shown up in your work in the past.
Okay, thank you so much for inviting me, Jennifer. And this theme is so much fun to work with. Oh my gosh. And I have a poem that's titled Magic, but it's a poem I'm going to read a little bit later because I'd like to focus first on what we tend to think of as magic when we think of Halloween and witchcraft and casting spells and hurling curses and changing something. You know, something is mysteriously changing and witches are on their broomsticks riding through the air. And then that's really the night before the Day of the Dead. And so we've got ghosts coming into the conversation and about magic. And we've got, oh my gosh, so many things. So I'll start out with that theme of witchcraft and casting spells and curses, because I couldn't resist writing a curse poem once. And I don't think it cast a spell. I don't think that my wishes came true, but the poem is titled Split Couplets for You from the Yucatan Artists Retreat. I must say, back in 2012 and 2013, I had a wonderful 3 months in the Yucatan Peninsula. There's an artist's retreat, and this poem grew out of it. Split Couplets for You from the Yucatan Artists Retreat. You were so ecstatic to leave, as were we, to finally see the end to your claims on our attention, your whining, your endless pining for civilization, the latest New Yorker, jungle heat that rumpled your feathers bathes us, it loves us, invites brave new insights into the bright complexities of work we'd go berserk if kept from any longer by your venom, your threats of shutdown, no more the terrible countdown till your sweet departure. Oh, it was waiting for Santa all over again. May your luggage, you dear destroyer, be filled with sand fleas, hitching a ride to your living room floor, and may your ankles stay forever peppered with bites. Would that I not have to write such mean thoughts ever again. Could say amen. Am I possibly of 2 minds in this? You wish. It was kind of fun. It was kind of a rant in a way, right? And then there's, I think, curses. There are lots of forms of curses, and a lot of people write curses disguised, and they don't call them curses, but they write them. And so I've structured my presentation a little bit in the following way, to read one of my poems and maybe somebody else in response. And Jennifer, you didn't know I was going to read one of your poems because you have a curse too in this book. And the title of your poem is Big. So this is a shout out for Jennifer's own book again, which is just absolutely splendid and full of just all kinds of magic of various kinds. Big. I've made myself a sun, sent rays through space to touch your far face. Still you will not gaze back. When I blink out, may the cold cut. May you be lost in the dark. Yeah, so that's a casting a spell in a way. Yeah, so then there's other kinds of magic. When I think of Halloween, I think of not just witches, but I think also of people doing tricks. And the essence of magic is when people either have agency to change something, whether to change reality or to change our perception of reality. We tend to call that magic. Like when somebody does card tricks or pulls a rabbit out of a hat, that's a different kind of magic. And when I was a kid, I didn't know about curses. I could have written a lot of curses had I known that was possible. When I grew up, I went back to the school where I studied for 7 years in Aurora, Illinois. And I went back as a teacher, a poet in the schools. And I was hired for 3 weeks to go from Oregon to Illinois to teach at my old school, Bardwell School. And the things I remembered included some magical things. And the title of the poem is Imagine. Golden wood floor of the upstairs gym gleaming, just as when I was a child, and bleachers still rise on cement. Classroom doors with frosted glass panels, one clear pane in the middle, the way I remember, and all the stall doors and the girls' bathroom, still deep, rich wood, and marble floors of the hallways, the stairs, still green, auditorium chairs, still wooden and joined, and the vast three-story openness over them, all the way to the roof, and the stage with its deep red curtain, where once our third grade classes were Indians and pilgrims, where Mandrake, the famous magician, showed us just how unreliable eyes can be, and Dumbo, the elephant, soared through all of a Saturday afternoon. And here I am, 50 years later, a guest in this castle, in front of your class, teaching. That was kind of magic too. I mean, just going back there. I'll tell you something else really magic is that to go back there for 3 weeks, I needed temporary lodging. And this was in the early 2000s, before Airbnbs and VRBOs became really popular, before the internet was a place you could search out lodging. So I put an ad in the paper. This is a city of about 100,000 by now. It used to be 50. I put an ad in the paper needing a room to stay for 3 weeks, just a room to rent in the house. And the person who answered my ad had the upstairs available in the house across the street from the house I grew up in. That's not magic. Anyway, that was pretty fun. Not more than fun. It was really profound.
I'm thinking about some of the different ways that you were talking about magic in relationship to these different poems. And I think especially in that last one where you discuss magic as the unreliability of perception. And I'm mm-hmm. curious if there's a way that you think about poetry in relationship to that way of piercing that unreliability that we kind of already always have, if it's a sort of seeing through the veil of magic, or if on the other hand, it's a way of creating that magic of creating illusion as well, or if it's something altogether different.
That's a really good question. I might come at it indirectly.
Yeah.
Because poetry, we're talking about poetry in general, and I think poetry has the ability to, I think every poem is an act of magic in a way. Every poem is putting together a reality that never existed before in just that way. And each one of us is a conjurer of words. And we bring together images that never rubbed shoulders together before and experiences. We juxtapose this with that in a way that doesn't exist outside of our perception. And so we are creating a new reality in a sense. We're stirring the pot or whatever. We have a whole new cauldron and visions rise out of it.
I love the witchy metaphors.
My daughter was born on Halloween, so Halloween played a prominent role in our lives. No, but yeah, witchy metaphors. I like that too. Halloween has got to be such a big celebration here. I think it's more of an opportunity to have fun in a way, in a way that other holidays don't. Well, not that Christmas isn't fun with its presents or the other holidays people celebrate, 4th of July. That's okay. It's just a different kind of fun. It's a make-believe. It's making believe. And when we think of make-believe, that's kind of magic. It's pretend, crossing over realities, superimposing realities, maybe.
Yeah, there's that element of pretend, but I think there's something with Halloween that it also kind of embodies some of the things that you were evoking with those poems, that it's also got that element of I'm trying to perhaps trick you or curse you or things that we don't think of in relationship to most other holidays.
Right. Yeah, that's true. And it also, the whole idea of magic when we think of Halloween is that it does involve things beyond our control, like death or ghosts. When I was a kid, we had a Halloween party in which we took a walk. There was a cemetery within walking distance of my house, and my dad hid behind a gravestone with a white sheet over his head. We went walking, and he went, everybody screamed. Yeah. So the Halloween has that kind of a black magic element to it as well. So a different kind of magic is, and I'm going to turn to somebody else right now too, is that we think of invocations to make something good happen. I'm thinking of a poem by Billy Collins called Nine Horses, in which he invokes the spirits, if there are such spirits, in this piece of art that his wife gave him for his birthday. It's hanging on a wall over the dining table. And he's invoking the spirits of the horses to look down on the glasses. He says, look down upon this table and these glasses, the furled napkins, the evening wedding of the knife and fork. Look down like a nine-headed god and give us a sign of your displeasure or your gentle forbearance so that we may rejoice in the error of our ways. Look down on this ring of candles flickering under your pale heads. Let your suffering eyes and your anonymous death be the bridal that keeps us from straying from each other, be the cinch that fastens us to the belly of each day as it gallops away, hooves sparking into the night. It's that supplication, that imploring the spirits of these beings. It's a trust in, or maybe it's just playing with the idea that you could ask these horses, but there are many people who write to the animate nature of some animal or thing. It's sensate being. It's awareness that adheres us and that possibly through some agency of its own, it can do our bidding or fulfill our wishes. That's kind of a different kind of belief in magic. Thinking about Halloween again, Louise Gluck, who just won the Nobel Prize, has a poem called All Hallows. Even now, this landscape is assembling. The hills darken. The oxen sleep in their blue yoke. The fields having been picked clean. The sheaves bound evenly and piled at the roadside among sinkfall, and the toothed moon rises. This is the barrenness of harvest or pestilence. And the wife leaning out the window with her hand extended as in payment. and the seeds distinct, gold, calling, come here, little one. And the soul creeps out of the tree. Kind of mysterious. And the soul creeping out of the tree reminds me of a book called The Wishing Bone Cycle. It's a book of indigenous poetry collected from the Swampy Cree Indians. And I used to teach that book, those poems, when I did poetry writing with children. And there's a lot of magical thinking in indigenous cultures and beliefs that are not common to us in the Western world, certainly. One of those beliefs is that one's ancestors might inhabit a tree, for example. There's a poem in which there's a thunderstorm and the trees are creaking in the wind, and this voice says, maybe my own grandparents in one. There's that implication throughout indigenous literature that most of it, which is oral, but which got written down, there's a lot of that in which the belief is that spirits reside in trees. If not the spirits of the departed, then the spirits of the tree itself or the deer itself. Or my husband was part Native American Cherokee, had Cherokee mixed heritage, Cherokee, Shawnee, English, Irish, and he has a poem about performing a ritual when killing a deer and honoring its spirit and talking to its spirit. So that's just another way this conversation is going after talking about Louise Gluck's poem, which ends, the soul creeps out of the tree. Is it the soul of the tree creeping out? Is it the, who knows?
I think both that the kind of spirit inhabiting particular animals, creatures, flora, and also that reference to the Billy Collins poem about the nine horses, where there's this sort of speaking to the spirits of these creatures. It reminds me of some of the work I've read of yours where it evokes this, I'll call it, supernatural experience of the world. It feels quite different from the way that I think many of us think about encounters with animals or with creatures. I'm thinking specifically of this poem, Pot of Gold, that was recently out in Poetry Magazine. And I'm curious if there are ways that you think about that relationship to other living things that are not human, and the kind of magic involved in the relationship between humans and non-human creatures.
I think of that a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't intentionally bring my awareness, however, into poems. I don't read a book, for example. One I've been reading currently is a book by David Abrams called The Spell of the Sensuous. You know it?
Yes, it's a great book.
Yeah. In fact, I have it out here on the table, and I have a couple of lines I'd like to read on that topic.
For those of you just joining us, you're listening to The Occasion on KBOO Portland. I'm Jennifer Perrine, and we're talking with Ingrid Wendt. So we're talking about The Spell of the Sensuous.
Yeah. And it's a book by David Abram, who himself trained and lived by his skill as a magician. He traveled around the world doing magic tricks and performing sleights of hand, that kind of magic, not casting spells or curses or invoking the spirits, but no, just the simple plain magic with his hands, making things appear or disappear or altering perception or playing with our perception, not altering, but playing with our perception. And that interest evolved into an awareness that in indigenous cultures, each tribe will have it, people considered magicians. There might be one or more. And he wanted to study the effects that magicians had besides casting. Well, they did cast spells and they did invoke spirits, but how they did that. So he went to Indonesia and various other places in the Far East, and I think Bali was maybe one of them. And he met with magicians in those tribal cultures, and that's how they introduced each other. I think he stayed long enough to learn the language. And then he started doing anthropological studies, recognizing the role that the magician had in those cultures. And that role of the magician was to sort of mediate between the world outside and humans, the non-human, which is everything except us. And the magician had the role kind of as mediator. And so I'm going to quote from his book, The Spell of the Sensuous. It's early in the first chapter. The most sophisticated definition of magic that now circulates through the American counterculture is the ability to alter one's consciousness at will, yet no mention is made of any reason for altering one's consciousness. In tribal cultures, that which we call magic takes its meaning from the fact that humans experience their own consciousness as simply one form of awareness among many others. The traditional magician cultivates an ability to shift out of his or her common state of consciousness precisely in order to make contact with the other organic forms of sensitivity and awareness with which human existence is entwined. And there's the belief that we are inescapably entwined, that all of reality is intertwined. Only by temporarily shedding the accepted perpetual logic, because we are a logical culture, we demand logic, of his culture, can the sorcerer hope to enter into relation with other species on their own terms. His magic is precisely this heightened receptivity to the meaningful solicitations, songs, cries, gestures of the larger, more than human field. And he talks about the world being made up of multiple intelligences. And as soon as I read this, I thought, oh my God, that's how I've been living my life. I'm not a magician, you know, I'm not a magician, but it's like ever since I was a child lying on my bed, looking out the window and seeing this squirrel in a tree that would come up and just sit there and stare at me. We would talk to each other and then I would just study this squirrel. I just felt that nature had its own reality, and I was privileged to be able to participate and watch. And I've had some encounters like with a bear once, where I talked to a bear when I was hiking. The bear growled as I was picking mushrooms. That's in one of my books, picking mushrooms, and a bear growled at me, and I talked to a bear and I said, "Nice bear, you don't want to hurt me, I don't want to hurt you." Oh, and a line from that poem is in a Portland sidewalk downtown: "I'm here, you're there, that's fine."
That feels like a line, a quote that we might need to recall more and more right now.
Yeah. It's on Yamhill, but between 2nd and 3rd Avenue and outside the parking garage. Anyway, so I've had encounters with animals, and the one you're talking about in Poetry Magazine, I could read that perhaps, because sure. I did have a very close encounter with one special fish. It's a long poem, so I'm going to warn the readers. I don't want to rush it, but it might take 5 minutes. Pot of gold. And the reason it's called pot of gold is because ultimately at the end of this poem, I connect with a parrotfish. It's called a rainbow parrotfish. And you know what's at the end of the rainbow is the pot of gold, right? So I found this rainbow parrotfish. And I have an imaginary person I'm talking to here, my neighbor, actually. She talks a lot about mindfulness. "We talk, you and I, of mindfulness here in the world above water. But what's below is watchfulness, pure and simple. Creatures trying not to be eaten. Creatures relentlessly prowling or simply waiting for meals to cruise on by, except maybe parrotfish. Ever industrious, ever in motion, it's hard to find one not chomping on Yucatan limestone reefs. What we see as dead bleached coral or crusted limestone shelves for them is re-embodied fish delight, which means I find them by eavesdropping. Ah, those castanet choruses clicking, clacking, a coven of promises leading me on until there, below my mask and snorkel, a dozen or more upside-down princesses sway as one in their pink and blue checkerboard gowns, their long, long dorsal crowns, cobalt-striped and turquoise and fuchsia. Useless, no prince to be found, not even in fish identification books, just me and my ardor. Bewitched, each day I hang transfixed above them in a slightly different place in that once pristine, once undiscovered Yalku Lagoon, its cradling mix of salt and fresh water letting me hold myself and time and the rest of the world stock still. Sometimes I'm even luckier. Out of the deepest shadows as out of my book ventures the shy midnight parrot, a constellation of neon blue mosaic scrawled on its head, its body 2 feet long, as dark as blue can get and still not be black, its parrot beak, that family trait, munching rocks and shitting sand, puffs of it, great big clouds of it, murking the water until finally settling down. That's how some scientists say sandy floors of tropical reefs are born. But had I dared the slightest move, my midnight would have just like that become dawn. And so it could have been as well with that one tremendous fish, secretive, off at the edge, among a maze of boulders, piled on boulders, broken sandstone columns, deep channels between them, there, in a shaft of sun, the end of all my seeking. And what I hadn't known, I'd sought. 3 feet long at least, and all alone, clown-sized lips and eyelids, the brightest possible aqua blue and an orange gold face, the way a child might rob its mother's most dramatic eyeshadow onto the most unlikely places, forehead, cheeks, even the outermost edges of every single emerald green fin, even the edge of the deep red tail, its tips turned up at the corners. That tremendous fish was eating nothing. That fish wasn't moving at all, except it turned its head. And one tremendous eye caught mine and held it taut. Oh, I almost stopped breathing. And the fish stopped everything too, except for slowly pulsing gills, opening, closing, opening, closing, in sync with my own pounding heart. Was I the watcher or the watched? How long did we stay like that, hooked to one another, held in water's palm? As through my every cell over and over rang, rainbow, unstoppable rainbow, until I had no beginning, I had no end. Rainbow I was and happily would be still, had not a wayward cloud blundered in. And that poem is dedicated to Elizabeth Bishop, 1911 to 1979, with gratitude for all of her work, but especially her poem titled The Fish, which was a rainbow trout which she let go. The line rainbow, rainbow, rainbow was in there. So I just expanded it.
I love that extraordinary moment of questioning whether the speaker in the poem is the watcher or the one being watched. And I feel like that speaks so much to that passage from David Abrams that you read of that sense of a shifting out of consciousness, where suddenly it's possible that the sort of primary seat of consciousness isn't us, isn't humans. It might be something else.
True. And then you somehow connect with it in a way that's totally magical. That's all mm-hmm. I can say.
Yeah.
There's no other word for it. And there's a passage in his book also where he gives an example of sitting high up in some craggy place on a mountain and just watching the sky and just practicing one of his magic tricks by rolling a coin across his fingers, and the sunlight was catching the coin that was rolling across his back of his hand, and the sunlight must have bounced off of it, and a giant condor started coming toward him, and he stopped doing that, and the condor went away, and then he continued doing it, and the condor came back until the condor, he kept doing it and kept doing it. The condor was just a few feet away, and then the condor hung there, and they all stared at each other. So,
wow.
Yeah. And something else about this book is that thinking about magic and being a magician, I think all poets maybe in some way live both in this world, this human community, but they're also at the edge of another world. And for me, I'm at the edge of the natural world. That's where I choose to be. And the magician, tribal cultures, lives outside, not far from, but outside of the village in order to maintain connection with the non-human world, in order to more fully act as its medium. He can't be caught up, or he or she can't be caught up in the everyday, day-to-day of the village, because he or she would lose touch with the contacts with the natural world, if that makes any sense.
Well, it makes me think too of, especially that concept of living outside the village, that even in the poems that you read just now, that poem and then the first poem that you read are both set or have moments in the Yucatan. And so many of your poems that I've read have been about experiences of travel. And I wonder too, if travel is also a way of living outside the village, maybe not to be closer to the non-human world, but to be closer to a different kind of world that we could normally experience as other.
I think you're right. Yeah, because sometimes we're connecting with other things, non-human things. But there are other things that happen too that I consider magical, such as synchronicity. That's also something that is not happening at the agency of any known person, like the agency of the magician who changes things or casts spells. And it's not the agency of an animal or the, you know, it's what's happening is that two things come together that don't really belong together in a strange and unusual way that makes us wonder whether there is something greater out there. We just don't know what to think about synchronous events. And Carl Jung used to, has written a great deal about that. People who are Jungians talk a great deal about synchronicity. And so poem is titled Synchronicity, and it's a narrative. I was at the Wurlitzer Foundation in Mexico, New Mexico, for a couple of weeks. And during that time, an event happened back in that rustic laundry cabin doubling as Wurlitzer Library. Yes, I could have carried back to my room that book by Jung. Yes, I saw it lying there unshelved next to our communal washer and dryer left by another artist I'd still to meet, like me, in retreat from the everyday world of phones and programs, because I have big things to write, because I've brought my notes for a series on death and the maiden I used to be, notes on the Holocaust, Catholic saints, because I'd already checked out a book of poems by someone who almost became a friend when we were students 30 years back, but he left to teach in a state impossibly far away. Our paths crossing, I'm told, on lips of friends, and here now on a shelf in this remote artist's retreat where it seems he also years ago came to write. And if that isn't synchronicity, what is? And though I briefly remarked to myself on this, And though a magpie calls to me from the tree outside, a flicker swoops greetings, and though a house finch trills in the wind, remarking my absence, my mind is already happily elsewhere. I almost don't take a moment to talk to the stranger who's just now parking outside, who's taken this moment between Denver and Santa Fe to visit someone no longer in Taos, and tells me he almost came the day before I arrived, and just now almost didn't stop, having lingered too long at a rock shop, as I myself almost lingered over the Jung, but said to myself, no, be resolute, 3,000 miles you've traveled to be here, 3 years of planning, not knowing I'd taken just the right amount of time for the laundry, finishing just 5 minutes ago, and no sooner, or yes, I would be already back in my cabin, never dreaming how close I'd have come to crossing paths with a stranger whose name is, yes, the name on the book in my hand, whose wonder, like mine, could go on like planets in separate orbits forever, unfolding, unfolding, as in the living desert where flowers open right under our eyes. Because that synchronicity, there's no agency that we know of making these two things happen. These two events, my holding the book and his showing up in the middle of Taos, New Mexico. Yeah. We had met in Oregon. Things like that. But this is a different kind of magic, and the poem is titled Magic. My husband died 3 years ago, and it took me a good year to even write anything about it, about him, although I wrote to him in my journal every day for months. And then I went to the Yucatan, where we spent a lot of time, not only the place where I wrote the sand fleas poem, but when I was there, I looked up and I saw these frigate birds and remembered how we had seen them together and remembered something else that happened. Magic. I want to emphasize that I am looking at the sky at an airport, watching my daughter or somebody fly off and watching the plane till you can't see it anymore. Suddenly you see the plane, it's tinier and tinier, then it's gone. That point where the plane with a loved one inside is still in sight, unthinkable speck, star that blinks into blue and is gone. Nearly that high, the frigate bird coasts over sea and shore and endless thermals, landing only to nest. Magic, you said the first time we saw it. Our private word for unexpected wonder. No matter that when we looked the bird up in a book, we found its habits indelicate. No, that first moment of seeing endures, a burst of beauty that blessed our day. And so it was a year ago this month, with the Earth's axis tilted and me off balance, souled, emptied, our souls retreat at the beach, and you, less than a month, become ash. Folded my heart, swept the cabin, and ready for new owners. Stepping outside to lock the door, suddenly, magic, joined at the stem, two perfect, bright red autumn leaves on the floor of the deck. Leaves I couldn't identify. Everything else nearby was green. I, Mia Moore.
For those of you just joining us, you're listening to The Occasion on KBOO Portland. I'm Jennifer Perrine, and we're talking with Ingrid Wendt.
I don't know if it was before or after I wrote that poem. I wrote another one, remembering him as he was dying at an event that happened just before he closed his eyes the last time. And that linked with an event in the same place, Akumal, where I went the year after his death, where I wrote the frigate bird poem, The Magic. Blue Morpho. It's the name of a butterfly. It's very, 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 very vivid blue. Blue Morpho. As when moments before your eyes closed that one last time, you opened them wide, your face, the face of the morning sky when the sun at last crests the far eastern edge of our world. As when I asked, what do you see? And your voice was luminous, yearning, sanctuary, sanctuary. Something just beyond the blank, pale green hospital wall. And then, birds, you whispered, birds. As when I asked if you wanted to go there, as when you nodded, as when I said, okay, it's okay, you can go. As when you sighed and turned to smile and we kissed three times, sweet flutters of butterfly wings. Just yesterday here in Akumal, where for the first time in oh so many adventures I'm here without you, I never dreamed at the dive shop to find a pair of bark-mottled gray-brown wings, unremarkable but for their size, big as my palm, frantically scanning top to bottom the whole big plate glass window holding them back from the blazing green jungle beyond. Not thinking of you at all right then, I cupped closed wings in my hand and gently, firmly with thumb and index finger kept them closed and rushed them out the open door where, oh, they were blue, pulsing, shimmering, open, blue, iridescent splash of sky returning to sky. Goodbye, you beauty, my love. I'm here, you're there for now.
It's a lovely echo and callback to the other poem that you were talking about earlier with the one that's on a street in Portland.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, as I read this just now, I made that first connection for the first time. Oh. And you heard it because we had just talked about it.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. And it makes me think about the ways that sort of magic as a broader concept and the kind of magic that we've been talking about in relationship to poetry is this way of, it can be a way of acknowledging the distance between us, whether it's because of death or because of just an unfathomably different experience, and also of bridging that momentarily, yes. Like that one moment where we get to dissolve that distance, even if exactly. It's impossible.
Exactly. Yeah. Those moments are absolutely stunning and memorable and keep us going, I think.
Sometimes. Yeah.
It's tempting to try to read a lot into them, but it's impossible to really understand them. It's a way of knowing that is not, you can't put words to it sometimes. And I think these poems are an attempt to set the stage for what happened, but I can't tell you what it meant. It's just, this is just how it was.
Is the hope in recreating it that a reader will also experience, maybe not that same moment because they can't, but will evoke for them something that's a similar sense of wonder or...
Hopefully, yeah. Or they might not remember something that has done that, but they might be more open to seeing it when it happens, because it happens to all of us, I think. But sometimes we're just too busy to take notice.
So maybe it's not even about helping somebody to recollect something they've already experienced, but more like the kind of magicians that you were describing earlier and that David Abrams was describing, where they make the way for an altering of perception, that a poem can also make that way for a reader.
Yeah. Maybe so. I like that. I like the way you put that. Yeah, because I do hope in my poetry to recreate a moment that somehow was profound to me and let the reader feel it for that moment. Mm-hmm. And I guess be open to receiving such moments and when they come, because they will come. But one has to be open to receiving them.
And it can be, that can be hard to do, I think.
Yeah.
Especially, I will say that especially in these last several months.
It's
easy to kind of close down and not right. want to open up to the possibility of wonder, because you're also opening up to other kinds of more vulnerable feelings too. And
absolutely.
Are there practices that you've had either related to poetry or perhaps seemingly separate from poetry that have helped you this year to be receptive, to remain receptive to those other possibilities?
I like to get out and walk when I can. You know, I think one of the things that I delighted in this summer was, for the first time really, being stuck at home and not going anywhere really, except on the wood ridgeline trails around Eugene. But I had a lot of birds nesting in my vicinity, and I have free feeders on my patio. And I noticed the progression of young families of birds coming to the feeders with the new ones coming with their parents. And the parents would first start out feeding them, that they'd be perching on the bars of the feeders and opening their beaks instead of reaching their little beaks in to get the food. They'd leave them open and the parent would fill them. And the food is right there, but they had to be fed. But they learned to do it, and they were so awkward and so sweet and fearless. They would let me walk up to 2 or 3 feet of them.
Oh, wow.
Not a spiritual practice, but I think I created the space that in my patio where they would visit and I could observe and observe them maturing. And yeah, that was special. I don't know. I would read poems by others. I turn sometimes to poems that have sustained me. I pulled out a book by Theodore Rethke. We usually say Rethke, but it's really Rutschke is a German name. Mm-hmm. He was born in Michigan. The maybe you know the poem The Waking.
Oh, yes.
I love that poem. I discovered that like when I was maybe 20 years old, and I thought, oh my God, this makes such sense. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I feel my fate in what I cannot fear. I learn by going where I have to go. We think by feeling. What is there to know? I hear my being dance from ear to ear. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. Of those so close beside me, which are you? God bless the ground. I shall walk softly there and learn by going where I have to go. Light takes the tree, but who can tell us how? The lowly worm climbs up a winding stair. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. Great nature has another thing to do to you and me. So take the lively air and, lovely, learn by going where to go. This shaking keeps me steady, I should know. What falls away is always and is near. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I learn by going where I have to go. And those paradoxes and that faith in not knowing and learn by going where I have to go. I think we've all been learning by taking steps into territory that is totally uncharted for us and feeling our fates, trying not to fear. In this form, he keeps wonder alive. Light takes the tree, but who can tell us how? Great nature has another thing to do to you and me. Yeah. One thing that I must give thanks for to my mother for opening the doors to me, to the minister of the church that I attended with my family. It was a Protestant congregational church when I was a child. I started studying piano very young, and then when I was 11, I started studying organ. I became a church organist during high school. And the power that I experienced was almost magical. If anybody had asked me to describe it, because the power of my fingers on those keys resulting in the organ, resulting in filling that whole chamber, that whole sanctuary with sound, I was at the controls, man. I was the magician, you know? And I could make that place reverberate. And also, I could make it hushed. And it was poetry and music. And then also through my hand, I could control the singing of the audience when they did the hymns. Mm-hmm. And I learned those hymns. Holy, holy, holy. And I was playing that music and they were all singing it and they were all together and they were all one. And we were there together in something bigger than ourselves. And I couldn't go on with music, but I thought maybe in poetry we can also participate in something bigger than ourselves. And also in music, playing the organ, playing not the piano so much, but playing the organ, I felt that I couldn't have articulated it then, I had no vocabulary, but I was a medium for something working through me. And I'm a little bit reluctant to call it God, but we use that word. I also use the word spirit. I use the word mystery. I mean, they're all the same for me. But something other than myself was working through me. And I was medium and I was joining us all together. Wow. Yeah. It was amazing. Just amazing.
And what a powerful experience to have, especially at an early age, to know that that something that you can do can alter not just the experience for other people, but the entire environment, that it can shift it so fully that you can make a space where people desire to sing or desire to move or desire to hold a kind of solemn space for themselves. That is a great gift to have been able to experience that.
It was tremendous. Yeah. And I think maybe that knowledge that is out there, that possibility is out there in poetry. What I most love is teaching others. One of the things I most love, teaching others to discover that they have the power also within themselves to offer to others an experience that they may also have felt, or to create, if only for just a moment, a sense of closeness or connectedness, that they are not alone.
Ingrid, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for being a guest on the occasion and for sharing your poems and sharing so many great poems by other writers. And thanks to everyone out there listening. And may you all be safe and healthy and kind to yourselves and to each other.
Thank you, Jennifer.
I said, if I can't feel it, then how could it be? No magic could happen to me. And then I saw you, I couldn't believe it. You took my heart, I couldn't retrieve it. Said to myself, what's it all about? Now I know there can be no doubt. Sleep.
skins. You can do magic. You can have anything that you desire. Magic. And you know you're the one who can put out the fire. You know darn well when you cast your spell.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Sound was used for centuries as a method of torture. Place someone's head inside of a bell and ring it.
Tune in to KBOO every other Tuesday at 3 a.m. for the Vinyl Pajama Party with your erstwhile host, Brian.